introduce you for a second.
Ah, okay.
I had the pleasure of introducing the next speaker. I am usually of the opinion that the quality of the speaker is inversely proportional to the length of the introduction. So I'm going to be pretty short. I know Rabbi Blau for longer than most of you have been alive. From the time that he was in high school, and I spent time at his house, his parents' table. Rabbi Blau formerly taught at Yeshivat HaMiftar. He currently is the Rosh Kollel at Yeshivat Shvilei HaTorah. Recently he wrote a book on Midrash and Agadah and how to read Midrash and Agadah. I can tell you that there has never been a time that I've had a conversation with him in which he hasn't caused me to think. There's not a single conversation which he hasn't caused me to think. I'm pretty sure I'll do the same for you today. Rabbi Blau.
But I thank Rabbi Grumman for his very kind introduction. We're going to discuss one of the perennial conundrums about prayer, which is the fact that certainly in our tradition we pray with a fixed text. We pray with words that we did not compose, and we pray with them three times a day, every day of the year. Or not every day of the year, I guess on Shabbat and Yom Tov the liturgy changes slightly. But we certainly pray with them very frequently. And there's an obvious question that maybe prayer is really about the spontaneous pouring of the individual soul before his or her maker. At which point you would argue that you wouldn't want any fixed text. You would want to just express yourself in your own words based on how you're feeling and your connection to God. I'll just mention there's really a much broader question. There's really not a question only about tefillah. It's really a question about religion in general. And certainly in Orthodox Judaism, we have a very strong sense of fixed forms, a worked-out halachic system, a very detailed halacha, halachot about how to eat lunch, about how to go to the bathroom, a lot of fixed forms. And obviously one of the critiques people say about Orthodox Judaism is that it's all this external performance, where is the inner world? Right? There's a critique that comes from various quarters. It could sometimes come from other religions. Right? It might be one of the debates between Christianity and Judaism. But Christianity will say it'll be about faith, it'll be about the heart, not about external performance. Obviously, within the Jewish world, more liberal groups might critique Orthodoxy that way. So I think we try to deal with it on both levels, both in terms of the prayer question per se, right, the more local question about tefillah, and the broader question about fixed forms and religious inwardness in general. Obviously, prayer is a particularly acute form of this question, because maybe someone would say, I can understand, you'll tell me how to eat lunch. Right, but don't tell me how to talk to God. That is much more personal, that's more subjective, that's much more individual. So I realize that this question is particularly strong regarding prayer. Okay, Baruch Atah Adonai Melech HaMashiach Kol Nehi Amen. Here we go. I just said that to recite a fixed form blessing. Okay. So let's see. Let's start with the prayer question. Is it really true that prayer was meant to be fixed? So that, we could even start with a historical debate. It's not obviously true that that is the case. And perhaps the best way to start with this is the Rambam. Okay, you probably learned at some point in Yom Yonan Tefillah, maybe many of you knew it already, a very well-known debate between Rambam and Ramban about prayer. Okay, what's the debate? Correct. Rambam says it's Daraita, Ramban says it's rabbinic, although many have pointed out when the Ramban says prayer is rabbinic, he means the obligation of prayer, not the institution of prayer. And the Ramban is not suggesting nobody prayed till Chazal came along and decided it was a good idea. Like, read Chumash, right? Everybody prays. But prayer as a concrete obligation for Ramban is rabbinic. For Rambam, it's biblical. But what is the obligation? Let's look at the Rambam. I know many of you know these sources. We can go through them fairly quickly. It says the Rambam, okay, I'm on the side of the page that starts with Hebrew. We'll have to wait for Leon Wieseltier and C.S. Lewis until a little bit later. Mitzvah ta'aseh l'tpalel b'chol yom. There's a mitzvah to pray every day, a biblical mitzvah. She'nemar v'avaratem d'Hashem lokechem. Mipi ha'shmu alamdu. What does tradition say? What is the service of the heart? Shavodazui tfilah. That's how you serve God with the heart. You pray to Him. Now says the Rambam, important line, Ein minyan hatfilot min hatorah, Ein mishneh hatfilazo min hatorah, Ein letfilazman kavua min hatorah. There are three things that are not established, that are not fixed in this biblical mitzvah. What are the three? What does he got? Minyan, how many times a day you're supposed to pray. We'll go out of order for a second. Ein letfilazman kavua. It's not clear when this is supposed to happen today. And Mishneh, let's say we'll call it the Nusach. And the text of the prayer is not said either. So arguably, according to the Rambam, we might say that the ideal form of prayer was indeed spontaneous. Right? The Torah did not tell you how to pray. The Torah just said that you should pray once a day, turn to God in your own words. So it could be, getting back to our basic opening question, maybe it does represent the breakdown of the ideal. Maybe the ideal form of prayer really is spontaneous. However, there is a limitation on this. Let us go to the next halacha. Says Rambam, I don't know what the word lo is in there, it's a mistake. Chiyuv mitzvah zu kachu. What is the obligation of this mitzvah? She'yadam mitchanein u'mitpaleo b'chol yom. A person should supplicate himself to God every day. U'magid shvachos she'kadosh baruch hu. Praise God. V'achar kach sho'el tzrachav. And then ask for his needs. Su'tzrech lam b'vakashav v'tchina. V'achar kach noten shevach v'hodaya l'Hashem. And then give thanks to God. Now what did the Rambam just tell me? It's not 100% true that it's a free-for-all. What does it sound like? The words are a free-for-all, but what's commanded? There is a very good word. There's an obligatory structure. Right? The biblical mitzvah prayer is supposed to be the old model of a king. Right? First you praise the king, then you make requests, and then you give thanks. Now this has halachic implications. I want to give more of a machshavah here, not halachic here. I'll just mention something very briefly. There's a Magen Avraham that talks about some women thought that they were yotzei, but just saying moda ani every day. Maybe they're yotzei, the Rambam's chiyuv tefillah. The Magen Avraham makes this suggestion. Arguably, according to what we just saw, it's not correct. Meaning, moda'ani is very nice tefillah, but it might not meet the structural requirement of Rambam to have shevach, bakasha, and hoda, praise, request, and thanks. So there is some structure, but I still think we could see a strong amount of individual freedom here. Right? You'll figure out what praise to say, you'll figure out what requests to make, and you'll figure out what thanks to give. Those of you who like philosophy, I'll just make a brief philosophical aside. This is particularly striking if you've gone through some of the Rambam's Mor Nebuchim. Because the Rambam Mor Nebuchim is very nervous about people saying the wrong kind of expression in prayer. Right? If one knows about the Rambam's doctrine of negative attributes, the Rambam is very nervous about saying the wrong thing about God. He likes the pasuk, l'cha dumiyat tfila, right? To you, silence perhaps is the best praise. So it's interesting the Rambam is yet willing to have a spontaneous ideal for prayer. But the real mitzvah is you could pray how you want within this structure. Okay, now what happened according to Rambam? Obviously things went off at some point, so we go to Halacha Dalad. We went into all kinds of countries. In different countries, you meet different cultures and you meet different languages. There was a confusion of language. Right? Some of you might have grown up in homes like this. I guess the ascendancy of English may be less so. But, you know, you have some family members from here, other family members from there. You hear five different languages in the house, right? You don't have a clear, dominant language. What happens? Now, at some point it became hard to express yourself. You want to give a dignified and articulate discourse. You want to express yourself well. But if different languages are clashing for attention in your head, it's hard to express yourself, right? I realize on one level, knowing different languages is a plus, right? You sound very erudite. On the other hand, ultimately there has to be a dominant language, and people cannot really express themselves. Now here I make a further point, perhaps another philosophical point here. Issues of clarity of expression might not be totally divorced from issues of clarity of thought. Language might not just be just a technical vehicle for saying what you have to say, but if you can't articulate yourself clearly, it could be that gets in the way of your ability to think clearly. That's also an interesting topic, but not for now. Says the Rambam, so people just couldn't pray well. It became impossible to go revert to the norm, which was the spontaneous individual prayer. Therefore, I'll skip the rest, although it's worth reading. Chacham came along and gave a fixed text. So notice what happened according to the Rambam. Historically, the original was indeed spontaneous. Maybe Rambam would even call that the ideal, within a certain structure. Unfortunately, we couldn't keep it up at some point during the Gola and Bayit Sheni, and therefore there was a need to create a fixed text. Okay, so that is one approach. The other approach, of course, is to say that no, on some level, the ideal is to have a fixed text, and of course, now the question is why. So I'm going to try to develop four themes. Four themes for why fixed text might be ideal, or even if not ideal, should be very much part of our structure. Okay, let's go ahead. You know, let's go a little out of order, if you guys don't mind. Let us go to Leon Wieseltier on the bottom. Let me explain who this is. Leon Wieseltier is one of the most important public intellectuals in America today, an editor of the New Republic. He actually, who went to the Yeshiva Flatbush here? No one from the Yeshiva Flatbush?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I believe he went to the Yeshiva Flatbush for elementary school. I think not for high school. He's not observant now, but when his father passed away, he wanted to say Kaddish Briar. He lives in Washington. If you go to Rabbi Barry Freundel Shul on a given Shabbos, you might meet him. Right, so he decided he would say Kaddish Briar, and then he wrote a book about his experience called Kaddish. Give you a good recommendation if you want to read the book. The book switches between two themes. One theme is a historical study of Kaddish, where Kaddish comes from, how different rabbis talked about it over the generations. The other theme is his little insights into ritual life. What's it like to have to say, go to shul three times a day and to say Kaddish? And the book keeps switching back and forth between the two. I'm going to give you a piece of advice. I don't think Weaseltail would be happy about this. To me, the little pieces of analysis about ritual is much more interesting than the historical study of Kaddish. So you want to read the book and save your time. I mean, they're both good. But you can just, every time you get to history, just skip that part and wait till he gets back to his insights about ritual. Those are really fascinating. Let's see what Weaseltail says. I'm on the book quote, the English quote on the bottom of the first side. Years ago when I stopped praying, the disappearance of the religious structure seemed to bring with it the promise of possibility. Every day would begin differently. The adventure of self-creation. But really, was every day, you see I typed it in, there's going to be some typos here. Was every day begun differently? I did not create myself. I merely acquired other platitudes and other habits. It is not only religion that lives by repetition. And sometimes we think, if we didn't have religious structure, everything would be so dynamic. Like, everything would be different all the time. Every day would be a drama. We'll get up in the morning. We won't be told to wash Netil Yadayim or to go to Shacharis. It'll be very exciting. Right? But Weaseltail makes a very basic point here. Human beings are creatures of habit. Right? Very often, the alternative to religious habits are simply some other habitual structure with which we run our lives. And it's not obvious that's a bad thing. Right? Maybe that's just the nature of what it means to human beings. Human beings are creatures of habit. That's how we're comfortable. Many professional athletes are like this. Okay, imagine some of you remember Wade Boggs. Yes? Wade Boggs is not before your time, or maybe he is. Wade Boggs was a very good hitting third baseman for the Red Sox and the Yankees. If I remember correctly, he was very zealous to have chicken every night before he played. Remember that? Is that correct? Very null. Right? Fried chicken. Even more specific. He was very, very firm about it. He would have fried chicken before he played ball. Now, you could say that is some kind of superstition, like Boggs thought he would get more hits if he ate fried chicken. Or you could say he understood, like, sometimes you're into a pattern, you're into a habit. This is how I go. My body's ready. I'm psychologically attuned to what I have to do tonight. I just do what I'm used to. So I think the first point about it, I think this is true, if you think about it, many aspects of our lives where we admit the role of the habitual in other areas. Like those, some of you who play for your high school basketball team, many people as they're shooting foul shots, they have like a standard ritual that either bounce the ball the exact amount of times or, you know, touch their socks in a certain way. And that leads right into the foul shot. So the first thing to be pointed out here is that we shouldn't view ritual as something that's foreign and extraneous and imposed by religious life. Right? This is just the nature of who humanity is. If you're creatures of habit, that's okay. Now, I want to argue that this played a great role in the history of our religion. Let us look at something very interesting in the Gemara in Brachot. Let's go back up top to Brachot. Okay, there's a Gemara in Brachot Yud Zayin that lists what various Tana'im and Amoraim, what they would pray in their individual prayer, even after the Amidah was fixed. But let's ask the question for a second. After the Amidah was fixed already, after it was already instituted, where was there a place for your individualized prayer? Anyone? So one possibility is Shema Kolei, where else? Very good, at the end. Meaning maybe the way Shimon Esri was supposed to work, you had your fixed amount of brachot, you got to Hamarech at Amo Yisrael Bashalom, and now the mic is yours, right? Now the floor is yours. You said what the rabbi said to say, now you express yourself however you wanted to express yourself. That was the original place for individualized prayer. So let's look what happened here in Brachot Yud Zayin. So we'll get, there's a whole list there, I'm not going to give you all 10, but I'd like to give you representative 2. Rava Bater Tzulute Amar Hachi. After Rava prayed, after he finished the fixed Amidah, he would say as follows. Okay, it's a text you'll probably recognize. Elokai Achelo Netzarti Eni Kedai Vachshav Sho Netzarti Ki Ulo Netzarti. Anyone recognize it? From where? Okay, good. Afarani B'chayai Kav V'chom B'itati Harani L'fanach Echli Malei Busha V'chlima. I'm not going to translate. Yiratzom L'fanach Hashem Elokai Shalech Ta'od U'shemach Shekatati L'fanach Merok Barachmech Arabim. It's Merok Avaloi De Yisurim Mechalei Merayim. Okay, now this is right now. It's interesting to get a sense of the person's psychology also. I guess Rava had an acute sense of the need to ask for forgiveness. This is what he would say at the end of the Amidah. This is what Rava would insert. And now notice it wasn't just the Yom Kippur point, but other Amorim said, V'hainu vidoi de Rav Amnuna zuti b'yom etikipuri. And Rav Amnuna apparently would apply this prayer to Yom Kippur. He didn't want to talk about this every day. Maybe we don't focus on sinfulness every day. Yom Kippur is the time. Okay, next. Okay, now you see something fascinating come up. Mar Braid Ravina kebe Messiah Mtzlute Amar Hachi. Mar, the son of Ravina, had a different individualized prayer. What did he say? Elokai Nitzola Shinimaras Vatayim Dabrima. I won't read the whole thing, although there are some subtle differences between it and the way we say. Now notice something amazing. What happened over the course of history, of course? We took what was Mar Braid Ravina's personal prayer, like we took what used to be the place for individualized prayer, and we decided to institutionalize it. What does that show, I think? I think it shows there's almost a natural reaction towards institutionalizing prayer, towards fixed forms. I mean, even, I didn't have to do a historical study, like how it happened. Like, did Chazal decide this? Did the people decide this? But notice what happened over time. Right, the original Takana left a place for personal prayer, and somehow that personal prayer also became part of the fixed rituals. Almost like there was a natural collective movement towards the fixed text. And so, oh, that's a nice prayer. Let's pray it. So I think that also might indicate this issue of human beings being creatures of habit and that not necessarily being a bad thing. Now, obviously, this is not given a positive argument for fixed forms. So far, I've just argued that's just who we are. But maybe there's a positive argument to be made also. But first, I have to tell you a good story. Okay, we'll go back to the Yeshiva Flappish. Okay, I'm teaching the Yeshiva Flappish in 93-94. I'm teaching freshman halacha. Okay, those of you who went to Flappish might appreciate this. I hated teaching freshman halacha for two reasons. Two reasons being freshman and halacha. Okay, when I taught high school, my impression was that students really only learned how to like think seriously sometime in the middle of 10th grade. Like 9th grade seemed to me like an extension of elementary school. I don't know if this was your experience, Ray Grummet. But somehow in the middle of 10th grade, like the light went on. So I didn't love teaching freshmen per se. I also didn't love teaching halacha. I preferred to teach Chumash and Gemara. Also, halacha at the time met twice a week. Good rule for education, right? If something, most classes meet 5 to 6 times a week, and one meets is twice a week, the students will get the message that that doesn't matter that much, right? So I didn't really like teaching. This is relevant to you also. Okay, so I didn't love teaching freshman halacha, but I decided I was going to jazz it up a little. So freshman halacha and Shlapish was hilchot tefillah. So I decided, besides teaching the halachot, I'll do some of these other issues. So I wanted to do an exercise about fixed text versus spontaneous prayer. So I asked all the students in the class to write a personal prayer. They'll get some of the issues of what it would take to write your own prayer. So I asked them, everyone write a prayer and give it in. I'll look at them and get back to you. So everyone gives in their prayers. I'm sitting in the YU library with my wife, and we're both preparing classes, and I'm going through the kids' prayers, and I say to my wife, wow, this kid wrote a great prayer. Like, she really took it seriously. So I give it to my wife, who starts cracking up, and she tells me, actually, it's a Whitney Houston song. Okay? Which, you guys probably know Whitney Houston better than I do. I was never a Whitney Houston fan. It's a song called The Greatest Love of All. Okay? You guys know this song? Okay, it's okay. It's not a sign of lack of culture, don't worry. But, anybody know this song? Ray Berman, you know this song? Okay, so in any case, she'd written those words, and actually my wife saved me, because I would have come to class the next day and talked about how wonderful Serene's prayer was, and the whole class would have, like, lost it, of course, because it wasn't her prayer at all, it was Whitney Houston. But, so I decided I would get her back. So what did I do? So when, I thought I was really clever, you'll see in a second I wasn't so clever at all. So I gave all the papers back with various comments of mine, but in her paper, I didn't make any comment. I just crossed out her name and wrote Whitney Houston. Right, and so I thought I was really clever. Right, and I'm talking to another teacher in the teacher's room at Flatbush, and he pointed out to me that you missed it. You missed an educational opportunity. Meaning, I should have pointed out that this girl found it easier to use somebody else's words for prayer than to use her own. Like, I should have made the educational point instead of just trying to be more clever than the student. Then my colleague was absolutely right. It was a missed opportunity. And maybe she wasn't just trying to, like, pull one over the teacher. Maybe this girl really felt Whitney Houston had said it better than she could. So why should I make up my own words when someone else's words are already there? So I think there's a lot to that. So let's think about some of the advantages, perhaps, of the fixed text. Okay, let's turn the page. So we'll go through a number of advantages. Okay, now I guess I have to introduce somebody else here. Okay, if I mention C.S. Lewis, so probably most people in this room will think of him as the author of the Narnia series. Is that a fair assumption? That'll be your first reaction? Okay, C.S. Lewis had three different literary careers. Anyone know what his profession was, by the way? Nope. No, it's interesting why you said that. I'll tell you why you said that. That's not correct. He was an English professor. Okay, C.S. was an English professor. One of his literary careers was to write books about English literature, about literary criticism. The reason why they said missionary is because he was the most successful popular defender of religion in the 20th century. He wrote a lot of books defending religion, more than 10, and they sold greatly. Right, and that's why you think of him as a missionary, because he was an effective, as it were, arguer for Christianity or for religion in general in the 20th century. And then his third literary career, of course, was writing the Narnia books, although if you think about it for a second, you quickly realize that the Narnia books are also an argument for Christianity. Right? I realize you don't realize this when you're eight, but when you're a little bit older and discover that the godlike character dies for the sins of another person, it's not very subtle. Okay, it's pretty, and comes back for that matter, correct. It's pretty clear. Okay, which doesn't, I see no reason, by the way, to reject it as a result of that. I think actually a lot of very good religious themes in these books. So these are Lewis's three careers. The career that interests me the most, of course, is not Narnia or the English literature, actually, but the books on religion. He has one book about prayer called Letters to Malcolm, which is a exchange of letters back and forth. You know, it's a theme he used. Well, actually, it's not really the same thing here, because it's not exactly like Screwtape Letters. But there's a famous other book, which is Two Devils Are Figuring Out How to Tempt Humanity. Very interesting book called The Screwtape Letters. This is a book about prayer called Letters to Malcolm. Let's see what Lewis is defending a fixed text. Let's see what he has here. First, it keeps me in touch with sound doctrine. Left to oneself, one could easily slide from the faith once given into a phantom called my religion. Okay, let's start with this point. Like, let's say I want to make up my own words. So there's a certain advantage to that, making up your own words. At the same time, like, your words might not be appropriate. Right? One of the difficulties in freedom, right, is people can come up with various things, some wonderful, some mediocre, some terrible. What if someone's prayer relates to God as a mean tyrant who makes up these arbitrary laws just to bother us? Right? You could imagine that might find expression in a person's prayer. What if your prayer relates to God as your beer buddy? Like, you really like to go fishing with him. Right? There might also come as an expression in someone's prayer. So one of the issues of the fixed text is that there's a certain conception of religion, a certain conception of God we'd like to foster. And we feel like the fixed text fosters that in a way that my personal prayer might not. Okay, let's move on to a related point, the second point here. Second reminds me what things I ought to ask. Perhaps especially when I am praying for other people. The crisis of the present moment, like the nearest telegraph post, will always loom the largest. Isn't there a danger that our great permanent objective necessities, often more important, will get crowded out? Now this is extremely important, I think, in terms of thinking about the Amidah, right? The Amidah is not only a fixed text, I would say there's a tremendous educational point here, which is what is really worth asking for. Notice something interesting about the Amidah, right? There is no request to have the biggest car in your neighborhood. Right? No request like that. No fixed text, I'd like to have the largest car in the neighborhood. Right? There's no fixed text to argue that I'd like to have endless corned beef sandwiches in my life. Right? These are texts that do not appear. What does appear? So apparently what appears is what's supposed to really matter to you. Like, notice that even the first Vakasha is very interesting. Right? You notice how like a little thing about text really conveys a whole philosophy. What's the first thing we ask for in davening? Knowledge. I think one can argue this is a strong statement about Judaism. Right? How do things get off? We do not believe in a religion of the ignorant. We do not believe that you're just a simple fool, but you're pious, and that's good enough. Right? This is not what we believe in. In fact, this is really a tangent, but why not? I'll do it anyway. Okay. Earlier, over the summer, I was reading a bunch of Dostoevsky novels, and I noticed something fascinating. Okay. Very often in Dostoevsky, the religious character is also a simpleton. Okay, because any of you who've read either The Brothers Karamazov or The Idiot, it's very pronounced with The Idiot, obviously. Actually, I have a good story about The Idiot. You know, our 9-year-old son was once wandering around our room, like looking at the books, and he goes, "Who would write a book called The Idiot? What a strange thing to do." But in any case, Dostoevsky did do so. But the religious individual is someone who's a simpleton. Right? That's not what we believe. We believe in knowledge, in wisdom. I would argue a lot of that is manifest in the first request. Requests get off the ground by asking for dot, by asking for bina. There's a message there. There's a message of the fact that we ask for refuah, right, for sustenance, right, that these things are valid, asking for forgiveness. And then, of course, as we move on, we move from personal requests to, or individualized requests, to more national issues, right, kibbutz goliot and binyan Yerushalayim. Right, the daily Amidah is a constant educational maneuver, an occasional structure, strategy about what really matters in life. So I think this is an important point also. Now, this doesn't mean no one can ever pray for anything else. Let me clarify that point. Again, this is not to the exclusion of the personal or to the exclusion of the individualized, but that there's a value to the fixed form, I think, is something that emerges very carefully, very clearly. Now, this is something that also appears in our sources. If we go back to the other side for a second, see the Kuzri. Let's see the Kuzri for a second here. So the Kuzri, the famous dialogue of Rabbi Yehuda Levi between the Khazar king and the Jewish sage. So the Khazar king asked this question. Amar Kuzri Balamazde Haloshitiachir Adam Yotov, Vitianap Shozaha Mashatop New York. This is a little bit of a related question, not exactly the same question. This is not about fixed text for spontaneous prayer, but about praying with a minion versus praying by myself. Right? The king of the Khazar says, wouldn't it be more inspiring to go to the mountains and be by myself in a cave, and there I'll pray? Why do I have to pray with everybody else? Says the sage, Amar Khaber, Avoyitaron Lakal Mikam Panim. There's many advantages to praying with the community. Mehem among them, ki akahal einam mitpalim b'mashi yishpo hefseid liyachid. That tzibur does not pray for what is negative to individual. Right, we're not going to get together and say, let us pray that Lenny over there in the corner should lose his business. Right, that usually tends to not be a communal prayer. Right, v'yachod efsher shiyitpalel b'mashi yishpo hefseid liyachidim achirim. And we can imagine if everyone's fixed to, now notice, he's talking about praying with a tzibur, praying by yourself, but of course borders the issue of what you pray for. Right? Are people going to pray? Maybe they're negative things. Maybe someone's getting up and praying with all kinds of vengeance in mind. Yeah, I'll mention one other story. Let's speak more about the fixed text, actually. I was once at a question-answer session with Rav Lichtenstein, and somebody asked a very interesting question. Someone said to him, who should you have in mind when you say V'la Malshinim? Like, he said, I want to have Kavanah when I say V'la Malshinim. Who should you have in mind? Very good question. You know, it's funny, because like at those press conferences, people used to ask the same questions every year, so I was getting bored. And like that, like, well, that's a good question. That is a great question. So he said two things. One thing he said is, look, he thinks there are some people you could safely have them in mind. I think at the time he was Saddam Hussein. I don't remember who it was. Might then be you could feel pretty confident that they belong. But secondly, like, who says you have to give God the list? Right? You could just have this generic kavanah, like, Hashem, you should take care of the evildoers, and that's enough. But what if someone, like, that's the most important part of prayer for them? They like the prayer for punishment and vengeance and all the people they don't like in the community, right? So that would be a problematic. And if you didn't have a fixed text, some problematic expressions could come forth. So our second point, and here I think we've moved to a positive component of the fixed form. It's not only that human beings are creatures of habit. It is also that there's a certain quality control to a fixed form. There's certain assurance, as Lewis calls sound doctrine, of praying for the right things. That is something that is a benefit of a fixed form. Because that is point number two. Let us move on to point number three. Let's go back to Weasel Tear, the top of the second side. Yeah, I think you'll see that Weasel Tear writes beautifully. Now, there are many of these points I've thought of before, but it's just Weasel Tear said it better than I've ever said it. Customs have reasons, but their reasons are not their only reason. Okay, sorry about the typo there. They exist also because they have existed. Time is an essential ingredient of any custom. Every custom shows the smudge of time. That is why customs seem so opaque. Yet they owe their beauty in part to their opacity. They are like one of those Indian statues whose features have been blurred by the touch of hands over the centuries. What they lose in definition, they gain in devotion. I mean, there's another advantage to something that we all do, which is precisely the fact that we all do it and we've always done it. Part of the power of a ritual is the very fact that it's been done for years. Like, think about it both over, I would say, over geography and over time. Like, let's say some of you probably want to travel at some point. Maybe even this year on the way home, you'll stop somewhere, right? Maybe you'll stop in Europe, you'll stop somewhere else. What's some of the power of Jewish ritual? You're going to go, I don't know, visit, for the sake of argument, you're going to go visit Turkey, you're going to go visit Holland, and you'll find some shul, and lo and behold, Kiddush is the same words as you say. And the same words you said back home in Teaneck and Chicago and Brooklyn, it's being said here in Amsterdam. Right? This is a remarkable thing. That becomes more remarkable when you think about the fact that, you know, you could have had this conversation with your grandfather and your great-great-grandfather and 30 generations back. That's part of the power of a ritual. That's what makes ritual powerful, the fact that we all do it and it's always been done. That's one of the tricky things about creative ritual. I'm not saying no ritual can ever be created. Obviously, rituals have been created. What's a great example of that in davening in the last 500 years? A Kabbalah Shabbat. And obviously something that was created with great success, in fact. Right? Somehow very quickly conquered the Jewish world. So sometimes people can create a ritual with great power. At the same time, there's something funny. Like, let's say you're at like a Jewish retreat and they have like creative ritual workshop. Like, maybe there's a little bit funny about it. The whole point about a ritual is that we always do it, not that you made it up yesterday. That's what makes it a ritual. In fact, I'll give you another good story about this. I was once reading an interview with a man named Arthur Green. See, he tells a story about the Jewish Chavurah movement. The Jewish Chavurah movement was much more into individuality and creativity and spontaneity. So they're at a retreat, a Shabbat retreat with the Jewish Renewal, and they decide it's time for Kiddush. But, you know, because they're into spontaneity and creativity, someone says, you know, we don't say Kiddush, right? We have to decide. We decide what we say on Friday night. Who says we say Kiddush? So a woman gets up and instead of Kiddush recites a poem about identifying with being a potato. That's what she does. I don't remember the words of the poem. Right, but that's her poem. She's a poem about how she's really a potato. And then there was a fellow, I think is a well-known conservative rabbi, again, Joe Lukinsky, who kind of sheepishly gets up and says, anybody mind if I say Kiddush? Right? Okay, you can say Kiddush. But I think there's something to that. I mean, it didn't feel like Shabbos when you start with a poem about being a potato. But it felt like Shabbos if you start with saying Kiddush. So again, there's a power, there's a resonance, there's an association to ritual, precisely because we've always done it. Okay, this is a point that Rav Soloveitchik makes as well. Let's go to the bottom source. Rav Soloveitchik has a well-known talk about Korach, where he talks about his understanding of the Midrash, what's Korach's complaint exactly. Thank you. Thank you very much. What's Korach's complaint when he talks about the talit that's all blue and doesn't need trelet? So without getting to the whole thing, the Rav discusses this point. Let's read the Rav carefully here, because it's really two very important points. There are two levels in religious observance. I should actually give credit. Reflections of the Rav is a book that wasn't written by Rav Soloveitchik. A well-known educator, Rav Avram Bezdin, summarized many of Rav Soloveitchik's lectures in this book. Here we go. There are two levels in religious observance. The objective outer mitzvah, thank you, and the subjective inner experience that accompanies it. Both the deed and the feeling constitute the total religious experience. The former without the latter is an incomplete act, an imperfect gesture. Now here Rav Soloveitchik's already making an important point. When I'm going to argue for fixed texts, for outer forms, that is certainly not an argument that the only thing that matters is mechanical external performance. That is certainly not the argument. One could be in favor of external forms and still say it is absolutely crucial that the external form be accompanied by an inner feeling. Some of you, this kind of, did it come up yet in the Yom Yom? There was an idea about Kim Shabalev. Right, there's an idea of Soloveitchik who's very famous at developing. He said that many mitzvot have two components, what he called the maaseh and the kiyum. The maaseh was, of course, the act, the external act. The kiyum, perhaps the most authentic fulfillment, was not in the external act, but was an inner mode, an inner experience. And if you lack that inner experience, you really haven't done the mitzvah. So first of all, again, one point on the board. If Rav Soloveitchik is going to be in favor of external forms, it is absolutely not to the exclusion of the inner world. Look at his examples. He's got some great examples. In the performance of Kriyat Shema, of Tefillah, of Avilut, of Simchat Yom Tov, we recite fixed and standardized texts, and we perform precise ritual acts. Yet the real consummation, the kiyum, is realized in the experience belay. Let's think about his examples. They're very good examples. Tefillah. Are you going to tell me that Tefillah just means reciting a list of words? What if I think that I treat the words like the Fairlawn phone book? I just open up and start reading. Like, is that an act of tefillah? Right? It's hard to imagine. Isn't it crucial tefillah I have some awareness of dialogue with God? That's a famous piece by Rechaim Soloveitchik where he says, without that basic kavanah, you're not praying. Right? Kavanah for tefillah is not just knowing what the words mean. Kavanah for tefillah is a sense of omeid l'fnei Hashem. Says the Rav, of course, prayer is not only an external form. It is both an external form and an inner world. Without that inner world, you're not praying. What about Simcha Yom Tov? Here the Rav had a very interesting point. What happens when someone's in Avilut, God forbid, and Chag comes? What happens when you're in Avilut and a Chag comes? What happens? So you stop your Avilut. Now, what does that seem to imply? That there's an inherent contradiction between mourning and Simcha Yom Tov. Now, let's think for a second. Let's say there'd be no inner world of the mitzvot. Mitzvot are simply external performance. Why in the world do those two things contradict each other? What do I have to do for Simcha Yom Tov? How would I fulfill that with an external performance? What do you say? Yeah, I'll eat meat. I'll have a nice meat meal. What do I have to do to be an avel? I'll sit on the ground. I won't wear my nicest clothes. So I can do that while eating meat. Where exactly is the contradiction between Simcha Yom Tov and Avilut? On a level of external performance, it's not obvious that the two are contradictory. It's only, of course, because both of those external performances are meant to convey and express and accompany an inner experience. And indeed, the inner experience of joy and the inner experience of mourning, they do contradict each other. So it's only based on that Yom Tov cancels Avilut. So Rav Soloveitchik had many proofs, so I think it's really self-evident that we don't want the external act is not the be-all and end-all of the mitzvah. It's the external act that's reflecting, as accompanying an inner world. Okay, let's keep going. But yet halacha is very adamant about not skipping the external act. It doesn't say just be happy any way you want, although that is a debatable point actually on Yom Tov. But for many mitzvot, it's not a free-for-all. So why is that? Let's keep going. Why does halacha refuse to give primacy to the emotions, to the inner feelings? First, the religious emotion is volatile, ever-changing and unstable even within one individual. To correlate the outward act to the inner emotion would require regular adjustment. The mitzvah would continually have to be modified and at times nullified. The format and identity of the mitzvah would be destroyed, and no continuity of identifiable performance would be possible. I mean, what would it mean to say, I do this mitzvah and I've done it my whole life if every day I
pick a different form for the mitzvah.
There has to be some basic identity. It doesn't mean everyone has to do everything exact same. There has to be some basic identity to talk about an ongoing identity of mitzvah. What the mitzvah is. The same, of course, in terms of community. Second, each person feels and experiences differently. Rituals would continually have to be reformulated to correspond to the feelings of different individuals at different times. What was inspiring to one person might not affect another at all. No community service of God would be possible, since group worship presupposes a unifying constancy. So again, not just for me over the course of time, but even more powerfully, to the sense of community, to the sense of the historical identity of Am Yisrael, there needs to be a fixed outward form. And again, by the way, I would say this is not true only about religion. Like, let's say, I say, my family actually, I'll tell you a nice minhag my wife started. You know, what is interesting about American Jewry, American Orthodoxy, they like to celebrate Thanksgiving, and I'll tell you why. Because Jews feel very grateful to America, right? America did provide a very nice place for Jews to live for many years, and still does today. And we want to celebrate with them, but we're not going to celebrate Christmas with them, and we're not going to celebrate Halloween with them. So Thanksgiving was perfect for us, right? Thanksgiving gave us the ability to feel we're identified with America, but we're not, we are not going to engage in Christian or pagan worship. Okay, it's just great. So when we made Aliyah, my wife wanted to keep going with Thanksgiving, so we tried to figure out what to do. She had this brilliant idea. She said, we'll just move it from Thursday night to Friday night. So now, at the end of November, we always have like turkey and cranberry in the works on Friday night. I like to refer to it as Yom Tov Sheni Shel Goliath, but that's what we do. I hope everybody got that. Okay, looks good. Okay, but so that's what we do. Now, let me ask a question. Let's say I got up one year and said, you know, Noah, it's a great minhag, but why do we have to have turkey and cranberry and pumpkin pie? Let's just have steak. We all like steak better anyway. But let's just have steak and we'll let it be. But we all know that wouldn't be Thanksgiving. But again, the day has an identity. Part of the identity is that there's certain foods you eat. And you watch the Detroit Lions lose on TV, right? The day has an identity. It would change. There's someone from Detroit here. Sorry about that. Okay? By the way, it's a mystery. If you're curious, how did the Lions like get Thanksgiving again? I'm curious about that. If you know, you can tell me afterward. Okay, but in any case, this is what it is, right? For the an day to have an identity, for a ritual of an identity, it needs to have certain constancy. Yeah?
Do you think that
look, I think the reason why halakha likes fixed forms is for multiple reasons, including this reason. I mean, so far we've had three themes. One theme was, to review for a second, one theme was that human beings are creatures of habit. That's nothing to be ashamed of, it's just who we are. Second point was that there's a certain quality control to fixed forms. I think that'd be one reason halakha is biased in favor of an external act. Talk about what to ask for, how to talk to God. And the third thing is it creates a certain identity that makes you have communal performance, identify with Am Yisrael over time. I think those are all values that halakha appreciates. So again, I think halakha, based on multiple motivations, likes the idea of fixed external performance. That's the way I would say it. Okay? Yeah.
Just remind me, when the Kuzari says that we prefer to have a community prayer and a fixed form prayer to avoid individuals praying for the wrong things that would harm other individuals, is that because we fear that prayers will be answered, or because we fear that there's...
That's a really good question.
Praying?
That is an excellent question. I'm not sure what the Kuzari thinks about that. That's a very good question. Does the Kuzari want people not to pray against other people because God might listen to them? So obviously raises a whole theological question about when can requests have an impact and why do requests have an impact? Or is it simply that it would be bad for you per se? I mean, it would be an unhealthy expression. It's an excellent question. I think you could say both things. It touches on a much broader question about prayer, right? How essential prayer is, the fact that your request is answered. Maybe the value of prayer is not really your request being answered. It's just in what prayer does educationally for you. Obviously, it touches on that. But you could ask that question about positive things also, by the way. Like when I'm asking for something for my son, right, is the value only because God might listen, or is the value because per se that expression is a value? So I realize I'm not answering your question, I'm just broadening it, but I think it's a great question. I'm just thinking out loud for a second.
He's already skeptical about the...
what do you think?
He's skeptical about the... In the same Mamar Gimel, he's skeptical about the vacation nature of individual prayer anyway. Only
tzaddikim really will... okay, it could be right. Robert might be right. I just remember that. So you think it would probably be more about...
He used three things. He said prayer is only answered if it's prayer of the community, prayer equivalent to the community, or for the individual, like individual prayer that equivalent to the community, but that's only tzaddikim.
Okay, very good. What's your name, brother?
Raymond.
Okay, you went to Flappish? What's your last name?
Abbas.
Okay, I don't know if I taught from 93 to 97. They teach you your elders?
No.
Okay. So, Raymond's question is actually an excellent question. It's one of the things I'm thinking about. There's a, you know, there's a famous question like, why should God respond to your prayer? Like, either you deserved it or you didn't deserve it. So there's one of the famous answers in Rabbi Yosef Albo's Sefer Karim is that by praying you become a different individual, and therefore you are more deserving of what you wanted, right? You, so it's interesting in terms of Raymond's question, like, it's hard to imagine if Yosef Albo's structure would work when you're praying like to get vengeance on somebody, right? Since I prayed to get vengeance on somebody, I became a better individual, therefore it's more likely that God will answer my prayer. So, Raymond, your question is a very good question. Okay, anybody else with like a good question? Anybody with a comment or question? Okay, so feel free to contribute as we go along here. Okay, let us get to one last theme. Okay, actually, two more themes. Let's go to the last quote from Kaddish. Now this, page 369. This, both Wieseltier and Lewis say the same, exact same quote, and they use the exact same metaphor. They both use dance. Just, I wanted to save some paper and keep it on the two sides, so Lewis got cut at the end. Let's see what Wieseltier says. He's in a dance studio. I watch the dancers in class, and it strikes me that I can learn something about the shul from the studio. What these men and women are doing is not rote, it is practice. And there is nothing stultifying about practice. The purpose of practice is to repeat the elements of movement over and over until they are absorbed into the body, until they precede reflection, so that they may be combined and recombined as a result of reflection into the dance. The formal and spiritual breakthroughs of the dance are these combinations and recombinations. Might this also be the case with study and prayer? Day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, the same words, the same symbols, the same themes. It is often objected against the view that creation cannot take place without tradition. Now, what's the objection? That tradition frequently usurps creation, and so the diligent souls fail to fly. Right? You can't create because you're just sticking to your fixed forms. In the studio, however, I observe the diligent movements of these turning dancers, and yet they fly. I see that tradition must be an absorption, a second nature for creation to occur. This is a very profound point. What we think they're saying is as follows, and this is like a common misconception. The common misconception is that there are two things that are at nuclear war with each other. There's individual expression, and there's fixed forms. And the fixed forms of expression are at loggerheads. There's a battle to the death. Who's going to win? If we think for a second about many other areas of our life, we realize the fallacy of that. Sometimes a fixed structure is something that actually brings out your creativity. Right? It gives you direction. You work within that structure, and you find yourself within that structure. Since some of you might be into sports, some of you more into other things, I'll use several analogies. I know I have a bias in favor of sports analogies, but for those who don't like sports, I'll stick another analogy also. But sports is an obvious example, right? In many ways, right? Basketball has rules, right? And no one suggests you change the rules. But does that mean like you can't find your personal expression on the court? Of course not. Every player has a different style. People talk about how Michael Jordan played and how Charles Barkley played and how Kobe Bryant plays, even though they all have the same rules, right? Nothing's allowed to double dribble, right? But yet, there are different ways to play, right? You could pound the ball inside, you could shoot from the outside, you could run it slowly, you could fast break. There are 1,000 combinations. So that's one point to be made. Secondly, I think we said it very well. What do you want to do? You want to practice so much so you don't have to think. When you go up for the jump shot, you're not thinking, how should I shoot a jump shot? It's precisely because you don't have to think about it that you can be creative about it. Right, I know exactly how I do my bounce pass. I know exactly how I shoot my jump shot. Now I'll figure out how to use those forms, how to express myself on the court through those things that have already been absorbed, what he called things that precede reflection. I'm not thinking about it as I'm doing it. It's become instinctual. Right, this is true of many other things also. Right, about music and plays. They're 1,000 good examples. Right, think about plays. People will talk about this actor's version of Hamlet or some other actor's version of Hamlet. Like, so you guys should all protest. Like, what do you mean, version of Hamlet? William Shakespeare wrote the words some 500 years ago, and we're all just repeating his words. What do you mean that Kenneth Branagh has a particular take on Hamlet, and yet everyone could say the same words and somehow find a way to express yourself in it? But music, of course, is the same thing. Like, sometimes, I don't know if you've ever done this, you're like, you do a YouTube search for some song you like, and you discover there are like 7 versions of it. But again, like, everyone's following the same score, so why does it matter whether you're using, like, you know, Harry Chapin's Cats in the Cradle, or who did it more recently? Someone did it more recently. Or somebody else's Cats in the Cradle. It's all the same words, but yet it somehow sounds different when one is doing it and when the other is doing it. It's not only because they have different voices. There might be a different thing they emphasize, a different twist they give something. Right? Again, I think it's very clear. Fixed structures and finding myself are really not at nuclear war with each other. Right? Quite the opposite. Very often the structure is precisely where you find yourself. Right? Anyone here write poetry? Any poetry writers here? Okay, we need Rabbi Ebner for this one. Okay, I think you could ask Rabbi Abner if he agrees with this. I think he would agree. Very often with poets, right, this whole debate about poetry, right? Should poetry be just free-flowing? Or should we try to write within a certain structure, right? Do you have to write in iambic pentameter? Do you have to, the words, the lines have to rhyme? Right? Do you have to have a tightly worked out structure? So again, maybe there's a place for both kinds of poetry. But I think it's clear, a lot of poets would tell you the structure was not harmful to their creativity. It actually enhanced their creativity, right? By being given a mode of expression, even by being forced to conform to that mode of expression, that brought out certain resources in themselves they wouldn't find otherwise. So I think we've done enough analogies to see that this is really true. Now, I think we take this back to prayer. I think this is the fourth crucial point. We should not view the fact in prayer and in Judaism in general that we have so many fixed forms as we can't find ourselves. There's no place for me. There's only a place for what I've been told to do. Not at all. We could find ourselves in all kinds of ways. Think about the Amidah for 1 second. You might have different days that different brachot. I'll freely admit, by the way, I shouldn't say one thing. I should give an apology. Here I'm speaking about prayer. I freely admit I'm not particularly good at prayer. I can't say that I have great kavan on a daily basis. But at the same time, I think there are days that certain brachot speak to me and other brachot I'm more excited about. For whatever reason, what's going on in my life. Certain request matters more. A certain sense of gratitude matters more. And not only that, but the same request can mean a lot of things. Think about like a request like Sim Shalom. I don't think it's clear what the Shalom we're talking about there is. You could talk about world peace, about peace within the Jewish people, about getting along with your mother. Right? There are a lot of things you could think about in Sim Shalom. It could be a bracha that will take on different resonance in different days. So there's a lot of place for finding yourself within the structure. So let me just clarify the 4 points, and we'll get to a closing point here at the other side. Again, what did we argue here? I tried to argue that there's good reasons that Orthodox Judaism has a bias in favor of fixed structures. A, we're creatures of habit. B, it's a quality control issue. C, that it has to do with identity over time, identifying with Am Yisrael, the identity of the mitzvah over time. And D, that it's simply not true that fixed forms means there's no place for the individual. Very often the fixed forms can actually help bring out your individual creativity, as we see in sports and music and art and poetry and the like. Okay. However, as I've said, none of this is meant to deny the need for the inner world, and none of this is meant to deny that there might be a problem sometimes. It might be a problem sometimes that we talk so much in Orthodoxy about keeping halacha that we do lose the sense of the inner world. And there's no question that's a real issue. I do not mean to play that down, and we obviously have to come up with a good balance. Let me give you one source about this. Maybe if I have time, I'll do one more thing. Look at the Gemara in Kiddushin. Okay, this is a Gemara I discuss in my book, really fascinating Gemara. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Yitzro shel adam mitchadesh alav b'chol yom. A person's evil inclination is renewed, has a novelty to it every day. Now, Rabbi Yitzchak does not go on to explain what he means. I'm aware of several interpretations. We'll look at one in a second. Maybe I'll just throw it to the crowd for a second. What might he be getting at? What does it mean that the Yetzer Hara is novel every day? How do we know it's the Yetzer Hara? That is a great question. I think as the Pasuk is quoted as negative, like, rock, rock, halayom, what's the Pasuk that's quoted in Kiddushin? There's a negative Pasuk quoted. I mean, it's clearly, the context is mevakesh lahamito. I don't remember the exact wording, but you look at the context, I think it's pretty clear. Yeah, what do you think?
It means you can never beat it. We'll always get back up.
Okay, I mean, it gets renewed strength. Like, even though you win, it's still there the next day. Okay, that's a good shot. Anybody else with a suggestion yet, please?
New temptations come out every day.
Okay, very good. So, what's your name?
Noam.
Okay, well, Noam just said is actually what the Maharal says. The Maharal says, Yitzro Shalom Mechadesh, B'chol means you have different temptations at different points in your life, which is an important point. Sometimes you can get caught kind of fighting yesterday's battles or fighting tomorrow's battles. But different things are different. Just to give you one basic example, like if I say the word Yetzer Hara to a class full of 16-year-old high school kids, so probably most of them will think about sexuality. I think that's a pretty safe bet. But it could be if I say Yetzer Hara to, I don't know, 65-year-old CEOs, maybe the Yetzer Hara is like, who gets honored at the next dinner? Right? It could be that the Yetzer Hara changes over time. Like, what is the major challenge? And it's different in a person's life. Don't get caught up with yesterday's battles. Don't think into tomorrow. Realize what your struggles are right now. That is one possibility in Rabbi Yitzchak. Very good shot. That's what the Maharal says. Can we make another suggestion?
I think since we have to respond to the Yetzer Hara, it's that we can't have a static approach and do the same thing every day. Just as the Yetzer Hara.
Oh, that's clever. Okay, I mean, we have to be dynamic in response. Very good. Very good shot. Excellent. One more. Anybody with one more before we get to a nice little chassidishup shot? Okay. So let us look at a shot from the Shemi Shmuel. Shemi Shmuel is a Sachar Chaver Rebbe of Shmuel Bornstein. He has a sefer on Chumash of his Chassidish Torah on Chumash. He takes a very interesting angle on this Gemara. V'nir lomar, dasher nitan l'olam koach hachidush b'chol yom. There's a power in this world. There's a power of novelty. There's no denying novelty and innovation has tremendous power, tremendous force. We all get bored when things are the same all the time. That's fine. Now, here's an interesting thing. Let's say you're kind of a conservative, with a small c, conservative religious thinker. You might view this as a bad thing, right? You might talk about, what do we value? We value tradition, consistency, doing the same thing all the time. We don't value novelty and freshness, right? You know, read Edmund Burke and Reflections on the Revolution. That's what we value. But that's not the approach the Shemi Shmuel takes. Let's see what he's got here. V'hamaskilim, those that are intelligent, notlim ze'a koach lavodat Hashem. They don't view this koach as a problematic thing. They view this koach as a great thing. It's a great thing, freshness and novelty and vitality. And you could just transfer it into service of God. Now here perhaps there's, I always thought there's like a departure here between like a misnagdim and chassidim. Okay, don't read ahead for a second. If I asked you, where do you find freshness and novelty and innovation in Judaism? What would you say? If you had to pick a mitzvah, where would you find it? Where would you find chidush in Judaism? What would most of you have said at this point? Okay, so I guess maybe I biased you, but my reaction is going to be, of course, it's on the Talmud Torah. Like where every day you have an insight you never thought of before, a new angle on something, it's just great. Where could there be more freshness and innovation than in the world of learning? I definitely, if I had come up with this idea, the next line would have been the Anachnu Minasim Litzarich Hidushe Torah B'Chol Yom, whatever the case may be. Look what he says: V'chidush Davar B'Tfila. Maybe because he's Chassidish, I don't know if that's why. But there's no why are you getting caught up, you know. Right, why are you getting so caught up in Talmud Torah? There's Chidush in other parts of Judaism also. Right, Tfila could be different. I could say a personal prayer I've never said before. I could have a certain kavanah I never heard before. Right? Well, why does prayer have to be the same every day? The fact that you're saying the same words doesn't mean there can't be a sense of freshness. There can't be a sense of novelty. That's what we should do. We should find the freshness and the novelty in tefillah. And now he says something very sharp psychologically. Ube'im lav. Let's say we don't do that. We don't create a sense of chidush in our davening, or even in a broader sense. We don't create a sense of chidush in our religious lives. Chas v'shalem notlim ha-sitra achra et koach zeh. Okay, I know who the sitra achra is. Okay, see what you mean. What?
I'm in Satan.
Okay, it's a Kabbalistic term for like the evil forces in the universe. Right, so what's he getting at? So this is, I think, a very sharp point. We, on the one hand, do believe in fixed forms. We believe in objectified halakha. At the same time, we don't want it to be boring. We don't want it to lack enthusiasm. There should be a sense of freshness. It's not the same for me as it was 2 years ago. It's not the same for me as it was last week. If we don't convey that, and here I think sometimes I admit we educationally fail, if we don't convey that there's a potential, there's a possibility for freshness, innovation within our structure, so it's natural what people are going to do. They're going to look for the novelty and the freshness elsewhere. And sometimes, unfortunately, elsewhere won't be such great places. That's exactly what the Shemi Shmuel is saying. Yitzro shel adam mitchadesh b'chol yom. Sometimes the battle of the Yitzhara depends precisely on what is the expression of this koach hachidush. There is a koach hachidush in the universe. The koach hachidush is not a terrible thing. He's not against it. He thinks it's a reasonable thing. Okay. At the same time, if we don't use it well, we're going to find other expressions. So I think this is a good challenge to all of us. I think on the one hand, especially to the educators in this room, but really to everybody, right? Everybody's involved in the Jewish community on some level. Right? On the one hand, I think there are very good arguments for fixed forms. I think, by the way, historically, when sees this also, you know, very often, you know, religious groups that didn't have fixed forms, Jewish and otherwise, that they often struggle. Okay, one could talk about certain trends in Reform Judaism today as an example. Maybe I'll even mention a good historical example. Go take a little historical tour for a second. Let's go back to the Karaites. Very good. Oh, very good. Okay, what did Anan, the founder of the Karaites, say? What's supposed to happen? I don't remember the exact quote. Everybody's supposed to explain Torah according to their own interpretation. I don't remember the exact quote. That's what Anan said. It's obvious that that couldn't happen. One of my students said it very sharply recently. If that would have happened, there'd be no such thing as Karaism. How could you have a religion called Karaite Judaism if every Karaite is constantly reinterpreting the Torah to the best of their understanding? There'd be no such thing. There'd be no religion. Right? Every religion, by definition, has a certain sense of what we stand for. And what happened, indeed, over time with the Karaites? What, indeed, happened? They did it. We do talk about Karaite positions. Right? There's a Karaite position that you can't use fire burning on Shabbos. Right? They didn't have hot food on Shabbos. Right? No one said, but what do you mean that's the Karaite? There's no Karaite position, right? We have to decide every year if we think that's what Lo Tivar Resh B'chol Moshevoteichem means. But of course that couldn't happen, because then there couldn't be something called charism. So again, there are very good arguments, I think, for fixed objective forms. I won't review the four again. At the same time, in particular, if we're religion and we're within that religion, we particularly are strong believers in right? Halakha, details, mitzvot, fixed forms. We have to be careful that we don't create a sense that there's no place for the individual. There's no place for freshness or novelty. There's no place for individual enthusiasm. And I think in the ways we've talked about, there really is a way. Right? There's chidushim in Torah, there's chidushim in tefillah, there's finding different meaning in different days. I think this is what we should all be striving for. So I think this is a good presentation, a good way of thinking about spontaneous prayer, but as I've argued, I think it has tremendous implications for our understanding of halacha in general. You know, I could go on for longer, but maybe I'll see if there are any questions now. Anybody with a... yeah? Please.
So, originally, before the establishment of the fixed text, it would be when you had the feeling of prayer, and depending on whether or not it was actually a feeling, when you were praying, you felt these.
Okay, but don't forget, according to the Rambam, you did have to pray once a day. So it wasn't total freedom. I mean, you might wait till that point of day, that the time of the day that you felt most inspired.
Yeah, that's what my question is based on. So it's like, if you have that expression now, let's say, right? According to that mold, should you be going and saying, like Rambam says, should you say, if you feel like a shoot, like say another RV or something like that? Or should you...
Ah, that's an interesting question. Meaning, what if I'm inspired to pray at a moment beyond the three? Okay, that's interesting. Look, there is a concept of a tefillat nedava, of saying an added amida where you're supposed to add something. It's a very interesting question, Raymond. I guess I would say two things. Like, I wouldn't be against it. I think it has a place. I would say why I might be a little nervous. I think most of us like struggle greatly ready to pray three times a day. So I'd be a little nervous about like trying to take on a fourth on it. But it might be a problem. By the way, who says it would have to be an amida? Like, let's say you're in some beautiful natural scene, you're standing over the Grand Canyon, you're inspired. So it's true you could say Amida, you could pick some Prakim and Tehillim that you find particularly inspiring. I think that's great. I think it's part of what we should be encouraging more. We don't do that enough.
Give me this name, fixed forms again.
That is correct. Ah, you got me. Maybe I was convinced by my own talk. But no, you're correct, Raymond. That is a very good point. Look, you're right. You want to say your own words, I think that's fine. Look, again, maybe I've overdid it a little bit. When I talk about the danger of creativity, or like staying in touch with sound doctrine and what to pray for, the bottom line is halacha does not prohibit adding your own personal request in Shema Kolenu at the end of davening. So I agree, meaning apparently there is a balance here. Like on the one hand, we focus more on the fixed text, but there is a place for personalization. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, you made a great point there. Let's go. Next time you're at the Grand Canyon, you can forget those chapters of Tehillim, Raymond. Start writing your prayer now. You'll have it ready for that moment. Okay? Anybody else with a comment or question? Yeah, please.
I would add that, if I'm not mistaken, Chaim actually suggests that Tefillat Nedava has to have Chidush.
Right.
If you can't do Kadesh, then don't do it.
That's correct. That's very sharp what Rabbi Gromit just said. Right, that there is the Tefillat Nedava, you can't just pray Nedava Midah. You have to have some novelty, which would mean there's a sense that it would be problematic to just say the same words again. And the whole idea of Tefillat Nedava should be this kind of personalized expression, and maybe you'll use part of the regular words of Amidah, but you'll also find yourself somewhere in there. It's part of your personal inspiration. Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. Okay, anybody else? All right, I guess we'll stop here. It was very enjoyable learning with you guys.